pretty good sleep. They say they sleep about 7.3 hours per night, and only 5% report having low quality sleep, which is very much at odds with this kind of intuition you build up just kind of looking around you. But there's actually very good evidence that sleep, self-reports of sleep are extremely biased. So if you take a minute to think about it, when you are asked how much did you sleep last night, typically what people do is they think, when did I go to bed, when did I wake up, subtract, and that's the amount I slept. In fact, that's a very poor proxy for the amount of sleep that you get if your sleep environment is very bad and you're waking up and you're very disrupted. So there are a lot of reasons to think that this is going to be a substantial overestimate, and then people are just used to a certain quality of sleep and they think it's fine, even if it's not very good. In addition to that, I think one other thing that this data doesn't get at is the fact that the population is really changing. So in India, for example, the country is rapidly urbanizing, and urban populations are likely to face very different constraints on their sleep than rural populations. Think about noise levels, for example. You're going to have large trucks driving by, you're going to have neighbors who are noisy, things that are much less likely to be a concern in rural areas. So I think this is also pointing to kind of the importance of thinking about sleep differences across different areas as well. Okay. So where are we then? Well, currently we do have some pretty good evidence from sleep labs studying acute deprivation in developed countries like the US or the UK. That evidence I was showing you before, not sleeping is bad for cognitive function. But we don't really have any evidence thinking about the more common thing that we face, which is chronic deprivation, just not sleeping enough every night, a little bit less than we should be. Doing that in a natural environment rather than a sleep lab, and in a developing country context in India. We also don't know much about downstream outcomes. One of the challenges of this lab-style work that's typically done with sleep is that it's really hard to do it over much of kind of a long time period. Right? Getting people to come in and sleep in your lab every night is not easy to do. And so what tends to happen is they focus on acute deprivation, really keeping people up all night for a few nights, rather than thinking about this chronic deprivation and these longer run impacts that then you could study for things like economic outcomes, how you make economic choices, or to rates of time and risk preference, and physical and mental health. So what we're gonna do in the study, or what we're partly done with, is first we're gonna accurately measure sleep in an urban setting in India, in Chennai. Next, we're gonna evaluate three real-world interventions to improve sleep. And third, we're gonna estimate the impact of improved sleep on quite a variety of outcomes over a period of a month, which is actually relatively long-term in terms of general sleep research, even if it's not very long-term in the sense of our life course. In the study, we're actually examining quite a lot of different outcomes. We're looking at cognitive function using all the same tests that people in sleep labs do. We're looking at economic decision-making, so things like how do you trade off work across time, how do your social preferences change, what are your savings rates like, are you paying attention to important features of your decision-making environment. We're also looking at labor market outcomes. We actually employ people full-time as data entry workers in the study. We won't spend a lot of time on that, but it's probably important background. Health, which is the topic that I'll be covering most in depth today, given the content of the seminar, the focus of the seminar, and demand for sleep, which I'll also talk about just a little bit. All right. So that's the broad motivation. Now let me jump a little bit into the experimental design of the study. The participants in the study are going to be eventually 450 low-income adults in Chennai. I should pause here to note that the research is ongoing. We have about 350 people done so far. We can only enroll 30 or 40 at a time, so it actually takes about 18 months to run the entire study. And given this, the results are actually preliminary, so please don't cite or publicize them. We will have a paper coming out probably, or we'll have a working paper within about 3 or 4 months, hopefully. Okay, so beyond that, who are the people in the study? Well, it's a mix of both men and women, and they're low to middle income by Indian standards. So typically living in households earning about 1 to 3 pounds per person per day. And we have a few selection criteria for who's enrolled. First, the individuals have to live in a permanent structure. We don't enroll anyone who's homeless or what are called platform dwellers, people kind of living on the sidewalks. We don't enroll anyone who possesses possesses more than 50% of the home sleep aids we provide, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in a moment. And we don't enroll anyone with very young children. And those first three criteria all have to do with basically our ability to create an effect. We need to be able to impact sleep to study its downstream consequences. And so we do take some some care to select a population where we think we have some ability to actually impact sleep, right? So if people already have all the things we're going to give them to improve their sleep, it's not going to make a difference. Or our hypothesis went, if you have like a young child crying in the house, there's probably not that you can do to actually improve people's sleep. In addition to these criteria, we have two other criteria which are important. One is that they have to have sufficiently high baseline attendance. I'll talk to you a little bit more about that in a moment, but it basically just means we get people who we think we can actually get good data on. And we need to find people who are willing to work full-time in data entry for 1 month. Because as I said, in order to study the economic outcomes, we actually employ people as a full-time job. And this, I think, relates to the mix that we end up getting in terms of gender. So we do want to make sure to get a mix of different gender, of men and women in the study, but we end up actually getting slightly more women because there are a lot more women who can take time to work for us for a month. Although I should say that although this is selective, it might be less selective than it seems because there are also a lot of men who work in the informal labor market and select in and out of jobs with a fairly high frequency. So for example, we have a lot of people in seasonal occupations, like bamboo workers, who are out of work for the moment and come and work for us. We have a lot of people who work construction, stop that for a while, come work for us, and then go back to their old jobs. Okay, I'm gonna pause. Any questions on the study population? Makes me a little nervous when nobody asks questions, but keep talking.
How do you recruit people for the study?
So we send people out into the field in the areas around the study office. So I have a lab in Chennai, and we basically say, oh, we have a new job. Would anyone be interested in this job? And if people express interest, then we tell them about the job, and we tell them it's also a study. And then they come to the study office, do a screening survey, and do an informed consent. So they are very aware that it is a study, but the primary thing that it is advertised is a job, which is a little bit of an unusual process. I think for this talk, it seems a little strange because this is on health, but for the economics-focused talks, we try to make it as much a realistic work environment as possible.
What are the literacy levels like?
Literacy levels are reasonable. Not everybody is literate, and the data entry work is in English, and very few people are literate in English. But that actually doesn't end up mattering a lot because the job is essentially you have a sheet that looks like handwritten script over here, and you just have to transfer characters from here to here. So it would be a little bit easier if you spoke the language, but it's something that people pick up pretty quickly, and we can actually map out that learning curve throughout the course of the study as well.
Mm-hmm. I see that your study has an intended targeted group, but you mentioned in the previous slide that there are different reasons why people suffer from sleep deprivation.
Mm-hmm.
And the top of such chart is problem related to pain. Why focus on underemployed people rather than people suffering from health issues?
That's a good question. So I think we have a few goals in the study. The first goal is to measure sleep deprivation. The second is to improve sleep among a subset of people. And the third is to study these downstream consequences. And that really creates some trade-offs. Because I think in an ideal world, we would love to just enroll anybody into the study and get a very kind of broad population-based estimate that would include a lot of these issues, like people who are in pain. Can we actually improve their sleep? But doing that creates a trade-off for our ability to impact sleep, which lets us look at the downstream outcomes. So I think we basically erred on the side of selecting on people who we thought we could get a good treatment effect on for sleep. But one thing that we're doing to try to think about how generalizable is this estimate is we're going to try to run a supplementary survey where in the Chennai and kind of the broad area where we're doing our recruiting, we're going to get a much more population-based estimate of what are levels of sleep and how similar do these people end up looking to people who are generally in their demographic group. The other thing that I'll come back to a little bit more later is we're also collaborating with people at the Harvard School of Public Health who are running a 50,000 person longitudinal survey. And we're working with them to also get sleep data across all of India in a representative way. And we'll try to map some of our data to their data and try to understand representativeness there as well.
And the second question, how to reduce biases? For instance, many people are accustomed to sleeping few hours, but this is not a specific problem because this is like their body functions. How do you avoid such biases?
So we are actually running a randomized control trial. So such problems will occur in the treatment group and in the control group.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is really, can we at least improve for some people? So there will be people who have insomnia or sleep apnea or other problems we just can't address. And that's just a part of the net treatment effect. So I think, you know, it's definitely a concern, but we can't do all things for all people, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Heather, are you going to talk about the sort of the ethics or the ethical challenges at all? Or would this be a good point to just
Sure. Are there specific
question?
Ethical challenges you have on the topic?
No, I was just wondering in terms of running something with this sort of design on this sort of topic with these sorts of methods, what challenges did you or the team face from an ethical perspective? Or maybe you didn't?
I think in general we felt like the study was a fairly, we didn't have a huge number of concerns in the sense that it was intended to be very much a net positive on a few dimensions for people who are participating. So these are people who don't have a good job or have a job at all. They get a job, they get training on that job that's unusual for them. And that's true for everybody who participates. In addition, we do also provide, as I'll get into in a moment, treatments which we intend to improve people's sleep, which should also hopefully be a net positive. Of course, there's some question of fairness there. You know, not everybody gets those things. But in fact, part of the control group, one thing that we do is we give some of them stuff that they can take home that doesn't relate to sleep, so it feels fairer. So like, here's a nice painting for your wall. It's not gonna impact your sleep, but maybe it feels kind of nice, equally nice across people. I think one of the things that I found most interesting and kind of challenging in this environment was actually measuring sleep, but I'd like to wait just a moment to get to that point because I'll tell you a little bit more about how we do that soon. Okay. And good questions, keep them coming. Okay. So let me tell you now about the timeline for the study and walk you through what participants do and what happens to them. So the timeline for the study is 28 working days, which is between 4 or 5 weeks, depending on the holidays and the like. It's a 6-day work week there. So participants are enrolled over here on day one. They go through an 8-day baseline period. During that baseline period, there are no treatments. Everybody just goes about kind of their normal job and gets into the swing of the study. So they're learning how to do the typing task. They're getting a bunch of measurements done that we will later do in the post-line period so that we can improve our statistical power. But there's nothing happening related to sleep. And as I was saying, they work full-time in a data transcription task during this whole thing. Okay, so on this is the baseline period, at day 8 down here, we do a randomization. And that randomization randomly assigns people first to one of 3 groups. A control group where participants don't receive anything related to sleep. As I mentioned, there is a sub-randomization here, not exactly a randomization, but there's a divide here between people who get nothing additionally and people who get some goods unrelated to sleep additionally, but it's not central to this talk. Then there's a sleep treatment, or what we call the sleep treatment, where the participants receive devices to improve their sleep, really targeting a lot of those constraints that we saw earlier in people's sleep, so things like noise and light, and I'll walk through this in more detail. And finally, there's a group down here which receives everything that this group gets, and they also get financial incentives to sleep more. Best study ever. Paying me to sleep would be great. So in more detail, what are those things? The devices that we give people are, as I was saying, things that we think will improve the sleep given the environmental constraints that they face. So there's a lot of problems with light, especially because everybody lives in one room, and so if people are watching the TV or the like, it can be very bright. So we give people eye shades, we give people earplugs for the noise in the environment, and I would just emphasize that how important this can be in this environment. So in some of our piloting work, we put these environmental meters in people's homes, which let us measure decibel levels every few seconds. And we had participants that had the equivalent of a freight train going by their front door like over 20 times a night. Because people live on these huge roads or actually on train tracks and the like, so it can be very, very difficult in terms of noise levels. We give people a fan because it is incredibly hot. There are cots available that look kind of like this camping cot. These aren't too popular because they generally don't fit in people's house a lot, but they are useful in the sense they keep you off the ground, which can be wet during the rainy season or have rats or bugs. kind of a light sheet because it's hot usually, and a pillow as well. And there's two notes on that. First, the participants are allowed to take more than one of these things. I think we do officially have a limit of 3 or 4 or something, but nobody ever hits it. And the reason for that is, again, in the piloting, what we discovered was if we give people one, they give it to their kids. So it's very sweet, but it doesn't help us run our study. So we end up just letting people take as many as they want to kind of get the whole family sleeping well. And I think that's actually important to the interpretation, because you can imagine there are spillovers across people to how well you sleep. And as I'll come back to towards the end of the talk, the items are loaned rather than granted as a gift. And this has a few purposes. One, I think it's important from a fairness or ethical point of view. And second, it also lets us then try to evaluate how much do people value these things. We can sell it back to them. And we'll do that for both treatment and control to see do people who experience these goods actually increase their valuation of them? Did they think it was a useful thing to be doing? Okay. The group that gets all of this plus incentives, their incentives are increasing relative to their baseline average. Right, so people sleep a very different amount in the baseline period, and so we want to make the target something that's achievable, and so we basically pay you for each additional minute over that baseline level that you had. And I should note here, just again on a fairness point of view, the people in the other groups, the control and the sleep environment groups, they also receive payments, but they're not contingent on sleep. What we do is we randomly match people from these groups with somebody in this group, and they get their stream of payments. So that lets us match the same income process. Good. In addition to this randomization happening at day 8, also on day 8, we randomize people, or we cross-randomize people, to a nap. Remember, we employ them, so we can offer them a nap in the middle of the afternoon. So as you can see, within each of these groups, some people get naps and some people don't. And the advantage of doing this as a cross-randomization rather than an extra arm is a few things. One is potentially you can get even larger effects on sleep. And the second is you can actually measure how much does having a nap crowd out nighttime sleep? Like if we offer you a nap in the middle of the day, do you just sleep even less at night and then it doesn't actually end up helping? So this design lets us look at that.
Does the sleep treatment happen at home at their houses?
It does.
At home?
Absolutely, that's right. So all the sleep devices that we give them, we take them to their house in an auto rickshaw and we put them there and they get all set up however they want in the house. And then at the end, we come and collect them back. Yeah, so that one happens at home. This one happens at work. Good distinction.
Could you describe how it happens at work?
Sure.
You don't have high-tech sleep pods, or maybe you do have high-tech sleep pods.
Well, I will skip ahead a few slides, or a slide. Good question. We actually have, it's not a high-tech sleep pod, but it is a low-tech sleep pod. So what we've done is we take the second floor of our office, and we just set up what we call nap cabins or nap stations. So this is very much a similar setup to what we had before. There's a cot underneath here, there's a mattress, a pillow, sheets. This is an eye shade and earplugs back here, fan, and we kind of dim the lights. And this will be mid-afternoon, so it's kind of 2, 2:30 in the afternoon is the nap period. Mm-hmm.
So do you specify for how many minutes or hours are they allowed to nap, or do you just leave it until they're done?
It's up to half an hour. It is pre-specified because when we're looking also at the economic impacts, we want to be able to distinguish, I guess I'm going to get forward, also thinking about what the alternative to naps is, and so we want to have a distinct period where things can be turned on and off.
Okay, at the workplace when they're taking a nap, you can control that, but at home when they're sleeping, how do you control that? Do they come and tell you that you slept for so many hours, or do you have someone, you know, noting down that okay, you're going to sleep now, and then maybe reach the next day and say, okay, now you're getting up, something like that?
Great question. So I think you're effectively asking about sleep measurement. How do we know how much they're sleeping? So I believe that is my next slide, which I'll get to in one sec. One other thing to mention, that's not us. So just to be clear here, the people who don't get naps, they're randomized within person across days to either a break or work. Again, not central to this, more important from the economic point of view, but it is important to think about what are we contrasting to, right? So a 50-50 mix of work and break. So good question on sleep measurement. So this is a standard sleep lab arrangement. This is not practical, nor would we want to even attempt this. So as you can see, what happens in a typical sleep lab is you have this like room with blacked out windows, you have a nice comfy bed over here, you have electrodes stuck to your head, you have a heart rate monitor. They can monitor a lot of stuff about your sleep. And in some ways this is great because it gives you really good data. It's a very nice sleep environment, you can get very high quality sleep, you can tell people are getting REM sleep, which is kind of a very deep sleep that's important. But this setup is not practical, nor what we're really looking for in the study, which is intended to be more naturalistic, trying to understand, can we change people in their natural environments? So instead, what we use are basically a research-grade Fitbit. It's called an actigraph. It's about 90% accurate to the setup on the previous page in terms of sleep duration. So it's actually quite good data. Don't extrapolate that to Fitbit. I don't know if their data is good or not. This is the research-grade version of that. It has the disadvantage that we can't get very good data on things like REM sleep, but we can get some measures of quality like disruptions and kind of sleep efficiency. How much time do you spend asleep for the time you spend in bed? One thing that I think comes back to the ethical questions and the measurement issues here was, in fact, we did face some concerns with these devices, which looked basically like a wristwatch, that maybe we were like spying on people, or they just seemed kind of weird. You know, why do you want me to wear a watch? I'm working for you, sort of thing. And so we did have a variety of strategies to try to address this. We have all the staff wear watches around the office that look like this, so it looks like a more common thing to do. If people have privacy concerns, we'll give them kind of a felt cover so that it can't be videotaping them or that sort of thing. But I would say one of the more common reasons that we have people drop out on the baseline is they feel kind of uncomfortable about this. And so, you know, from an ethical point of view, we just say, that's fine, please give us our watch back and, you know, have a good life. We appreciate your trying the study and it didn't work out for you, that's okay.
Can I? Mm-hmm. As we were talking before, there are some people who just don't sleep. Some people who just don't nap. They could lay there for an hour and they just don't nap.
That's
not the way their sleep pattern works. That's not the way things work for them. Are there people like that in the study, and how do you fit them in if it takes them 3 hours to go to sleep at night when they lie down, no matter what?
That would just be, it would dampen our treatment effect. We basically just wouldn't be able to impact their sleep if they have some very serious sleep disorder.
But they're still part of the study.
That's right. We don't screen on that in any way.
Okay.
And we do have data on how much people sleep both during the nap and at night from these actigraphs. So I'll show you that data on what those distributions look like.
Mm-hmm. I have questions.
Sure.
One on naps. You'd mentioned that the nap stations were at your office on the second floor, and I'm assuming that you had controls for making sure there were no mosquitoes in that area. Would that have an effect on the generalization? The generalizability of the study, because if you're looking at the impact of naps, they will be in real life settings where there are mosquitoes. And the second thing I was wondering was that your study has about 60% women, and I noticed that your nap stations have a lot of privacy in that area. Women, I'm assuming, in real world conditions would not feel that comfortable napping in public areas if they're working in either construction areas or different, or in manual labor, selling vegetables and things like that. So just a little, I wanted to ask a little nuance, a little more on the nap, on the generalizability of the nap.
Sure. I agree. It's not necessarily fully generalizable in any sense. And I would actually say our home sleep aids aren't either, right? Because we screened out people who already have those things.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is of growing relevance. So for example, you know, we're studying data entry work here because we actually think it's a pretty common occupation. The economy is moving towards more office work and away from these kind of more outside manual labor jobs, which isn't to say that those aren't still predominant in India. They are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you're right that at the moment there is some question of, you know, is this the right nap counterfactual for the world that we face? And I would say probably not perfect, but I don't have a great sense about kind of how different it would be for, you know, like if it were hot instead of slightly air-conditioned like our office is, would it make your sleep so much worse you wouldn't get benefits? That, I think, would just take a separate study to know for sure. But I do think there are a lot of businesses where this model would actually be pretty appropriate, and the nap, I think, is aimed more towards kind of the firm side of the world than, say, the government side of the world, which is more the home sleep stuff.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about the watch and the dropout rates, how frequent was that, and what did did you have a contingency plan around what you could do if someone did drop out as well, like getting involved?
Yeah, so one thing that we actually did, which I think is a quite important feature of the study, which I probably should have highlighted more, is the randomization occurs here. So all the people who don't like the watch drop out before they ever get randomized, they never show up in our data. Right? So we have a lot of people who leave here, and that is potentially because of the watch, potentially because they decide this job isn't for them, they decide the commute's too long, any number of like 1,000 reasons why people might drop out of a study. This period lets us kind of let those people leave, and then we, you know, we're perfectly happy. If they want to leave, then that's fine. but we do want to make sure that we have fairly good attendance through here so we don't get selection in our data. So it's actually pretty beneficial, I think, both to them and to us to have this kind of weed out period pre-randomization. Does that?
Yeah.
Great. One other thing to mention here is we do also have some other sleep measurements in addition to these actigraphs. We have what are called PBT tests, which is the sleep scientist's way of measuring a strong correlate of sleep, which is a reaction time test. And that captures some element of both quantity and quality. I won't talk about that a ton today, but we do have it. We also have self-reported sleep duration and quality through a bunch of standardized survey measures. And we'll use this for two purposes. The first thing that we're going to do with it is just demonstrate that, in fact, it seems like asking people how much they slept is not going to generate great data. And I'll show you some evidence on that. So a little bit of a warning about people who do these surveys: are you actually getting what you think you're getting? And second, we're going to, as I mentioned, collaborate with people doing one of these surveys. But what we can do here is take our data where we have both these self-reports and an objective measure of what we think is true sleep, and we can create a machine learning model where we predict objective sleep from subjective measures, from self-reports. And then we can take that model and we can take the data from these surveys, which can be done more easily at scale, and we can actually say, what do we think true levels of sleep are using survey data? So this is going to serve that purpose as well as kind of making the broader point. Mm-hmm.
So I have another question. It's fascinating, the number of questions about how the napping works.
Yeah.
Do you impose rules that, you know, if you're going to the nap area, then you can't have your phone with you, or you mustn't be looking at your phone? Or are you interested in the fact that people are given the opportunity to nap, and they choose?
Yeah.
We do have to do something else.
Which I think maps a lot towards intuitions I have for like the environment we face is more kind of temptation-based often sleep deprivation, I think, than that environment. They do have phones. Most people in the city will have a smartphone even, like a low-end smartphone. They are asked to turn them off. Whether they do that?
Okay. No, I'm just curious.
It's a good question. I'll show you the data on napping. The modal amount of sleep is about 15 minutes out of the 30-minute period, which suggests we are getting a lot of people who sleep. But certainly, I'm sure some people don't. And it, you know, to the question on there are just people who can't nap, I'm sure that's true, and probably a lot of them play on their phone or something. Yeah. Okay. So let me start by going to our first question that we wanted to talk about, which is how much do people sleep in this context? So what we have here are sleep duration and density, so how much mass is in each of those points. And the really noticeable feature of this figure is how little people sleep, right? Our mean sleep is about 5.5 hours a night in steady state. Think about the last time you got 5.5 hours, and imagine doing that forever. That's the sleep these people are experiencing. The second interesting feature of this plot is that sleep scientists recommend a minimum of 7 hours, but preferably 8. Notice how much mass is over here, basically none, right? So basically our entire population is sleeping less than sleep scientists and sleep medicine specialists would recommend, and often substantially less. And I think this is a nice contrast to the survey data that we had earlier that said, you know, I'm sleeping 7.3 hours a night on average. In fact, it looks like it's 1.5 hours less than that. And that probably has to do with the fact that people sleep very poorly and just don't attend to that well. Okay, the next thing to look at is, since this is a randomized controlled trial, thinking about balance across our different groups. So let me tell you what's in this table. This first column is the control mean for all these different variables over here, which include both demographics and baseline measures of a bunch of key outcomes. And then what are in these columns is the regression coefficient for a regression where we are looking at the difference So we have a dummy variable for each of the treatments, and we're saying how different is it from the control group, right? So as a concrete example here, an age, our control mean is 36 years, and the people in the group that gets the home sleep devices is about 35 and a half instead of 36.4. And the important feature to take away from this table is that both for kind of key demographic variables and many of these baseline variables, there are not many stars, right? Which means that basically our study is pretty well randomized. It looks like, in fact, we're pretty well balanced. We do include a vector of control variables in most of the regressions that I'll show you later to improve precision, but they don't really matter to the point estimates.
Mm-hmm. Curious about happiness. How are you?
We do actually, I will talk to you about that later as an outcome measure. It's just a survey question that's used in like Gallup poll and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So a standardized survey measure. Mm-hmm.
Isn't occupation important? In, I mean, what if you have different sets of occupations in your control and you're
We do collect occupation data. It's often not great in the sense that a lot of people are just in the informal labor market and they kind of do a lot of informal labor market type jobs. We can control for that. It doesn't make too much of a difference. And I think gender soaks up a lot of it because gender is also strongly correlated with occupation in India. Okay, so the next thing.
It's sort of interesting, just in case we're sitting here feeling superior in terms of the amount of sleep we get. They spend 8 hours in bed.
They do.
And that's what we count, too.
Mm-hmm.
So there's absolutely nothing to say that we're getting so much better sleep. We have to wear one of those gizmos.
That's true. I would say the evidence on sleep in the U.S., which I'm more familiar with, is that there's much higher sleep efficiency, which is basically time asleep per time in bed. So it's probably about 15% higher in the U.S. than the data that we're seeing. So my guess is you probably do sleep more if you spend 8 hours a night in bed, but there's certainly no guarantees. There's a lot of heterogeneity. Yeah, it's a good point. So the next thing I should just tell you about is background is attendance and attrition, which came up in our design as well when we were talking about when the randomization is done. Of course, it's really important that we have pretty equal attendance and attrition across the various arms, so we're comparing apples to apples. So what we have here is a plot of the fraction of days present in the study, right? So there are 28 days in the study. And over here, we have a rank ordering within condition of the people in each group. So specifically what that means when you're looking at this plot is it's telling you, for example, in the sleep aids and incentive group, the green, that 20% of people attend 100% of the time. And then say another 25% of people attend about 95% of the time, right? And so what we can see from this plot, comparing these three groups, is that in fact, they're pretty similar, right? So we don't have any differential attendance or attrition problems across our groups. And I can also show you that as a regression table. So there's no significant differences across these various groups and how often they're coming to the study office and we're getting their data from them. And the largest difference we have is something like 1.5 percentage points, which is pretty small. Okay, so how do we do with improving sleep? We know that people sleep very little to start with. Can we actually improve upon that? So what we have here is our day in study. Right, so we go from enrollment to the end line, day 28, and we have actigraph measured sleep time at sleep at night. This is just nighttime sleep. And you can see in this baseline period, all of the groups quite similar, which is good. Notably, the control group stays at the same level, which is also good because you might worry if we pay people to sleep more and they know that's coming, maybe they sleep less here and then regress the mean. That's not true. In fact, they stay at the same level. You can also see, as soon as the treatments happen, the sleep group, this is the devices group, they improve their sleep by about 25 minutes, and the people who get that plus incentives improve by about a net of 40 minutes a night. So these are amounts that sleep scientists tend to think are pretty reasonably large. It's certainly not getting them into the range where we would think is kind of good sleep, 7 to 8 hours a night, but it is definitely a significant improvement over their baseline levels. Okay. Let me just also walk you through a little bit about what's going on in terms of sleep quality and how this change is coming about. Where is the change coming from? So this is just the regression table equivalent of the plot we were looking at. The sleep treatment is sleeping in a extra 25 minutes at night. The incentives, an extra 40 minutes at night. The nap treatment, interestingly, what this coefficient is telling us is that, at least in a marginally significant way, if you nap, you sleep a little bit less at night. It's only about 6 minutes, so it's not a huge effect, but it is there. It doesn't seem like there's much going on with sleep efficiency, which was actually a bit surprising for us. Part of the goal of giving people these sleep devices was, in fact, to really try to target causes of poor sleep. And so the goal was actually to use that time better. It turns out it doesn't look like there's a lot going on there. Maybe there's a little bit in this incentives treatment, but not a huge impact overall. In addition, we can look at if sleep efficiency isn't changing, is it about the timing of the sleep?
How did you decide on the time frame of the napping, and also did you wake them up?
We do wake them up. The nap is at a specific time in the afternoon, I think it's 2:30.
But the length of the nap?
Oh, the 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So we talked with sleep scientists. There are actually some really, really interesting sleep scientists who are great to chat with. So their suggestion was you either should go for like a 30-minute nap or like a 2-hour nap because of these REM cycles. So what happens is if you do an amount that's in between, you get these people become very groggy. It's what they call sleep inertia. And so if you do a short nap, people can get a little bit of rest, but they wake up pretty well from it. If you do a 2-hour nap, they go through a whole REM cycle, they can wake up well from it. But if you do an in-between amount, it's not great. And we didn't really have time for a 2-hour nap, so we went with half an hour.
Is there any correlation between a half an hour or a 2-hour nap, like, on how much sleep you would get at night? Like, would you, so the 6 minutes was for the 30 minutes, but is there, like, a bigger correlation if you take a 2-hour nap?
I'm sure there would be. We don't have data on it in this experiment, but I think the evidence from sleep labs is that you do get more nighttime crowd out if you take a very long daytime nap. But it probably depends a little bit on kind of what your baseline nighttime sleep is as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Could you guys tell me more about what sleep efficiency means?
Sure. So as I say with the actigraphs, you can't get great measurements of the type of sleep that people are getting, the quality. But what you can do is you can take the time they spend in bed and the time they sleep, and you can divide those two. That's basically this measure. So you can either look at that or what are called disruptions, which are fairly major movements at night. And neither of them seems to show much of a difference. Yeah. And this is a little bit wishy-washy, I should say, because when people go to bed is also not great to measure. We tried 1,000 ways to get that, having them text us before they went to sleep, and none of it really worked very well. So basically what you have to do is look at the data and try to guess roughly when they go to bed by looking at movement. So there are algorithms for that, but I would say it probably is not perfect. Okay. So then, if people aren't sleeping more deeply or more solidly, where is the gain in sleep coming from? Well, it's coming from the fact that they're going to bed earlier and they're getting up later. So we can also see that graphically. What we have here is the time at night. So here's midnight, here's 9 p.m., here's 9 a.m., and this is the fraction of people asleep according to the watch. And as you can see, even in the dead of night, sleep efficiency is not great. It's about 70%. You see more numbers more like 85% typically in developed countries. But over on these edges, you see people in the sleep treatments going to bed earlier and getting up later. So that's where a lot of these gains are coming from. Okay. I also just want to take a little bit of time and talk a bit about whether these effects vary by gender. And surprisingly to me, there are not significant effects across some different aspects of heterogeneity that I might have guessed would be important. So let me describe the table first. What we're doing in this table is we're looking at nighttime sleep is always the outcome variable, and it is a function of the different treatment arms that we've been talking about, and also a key covariate of interest, say gender, age, or earnings. And so for each of those, we have always the two dummy variables for the treatments. We also have a dummy variable in each separate regression for the covariate of interest. And then we have interaction terms between the treatment and the interaction term of interest, so gender, age, and income. So the key coefficients of interest are down here. And the fact that you don't see anything that's significant is basically telling us that none of these various factors, gender, age, or earnings, interact significantly with the treatments. Say women are not reacting more than men to the treatment or the like. There is a little bit of suggestive evidence maybe here as we get that in fact maybe women will be a little bit more impacted by the incentives arm. And we've seen some qualitative remarks on that from people in our data too, who will tell us things at debriefing like, well, I told my husband that I was getting paid to sleep, so he got up in the morning to take care of the kids. But I don't know. We'll see if it ends up being a significant thing or not. But right now, we're not seeing a lot on the heterogeneity front. Okay. Last thing to talk about on sleep before naps is to go back to this point about self-reports. So what we're showing you in this plot is sleep duration at night. This is just the density plot again. We're using the same color code, so red is control, blue is the devices group, green is the incentives group. Solid lines are the actigraph measured data, and dotted lines are the self-reports. And the very clear pattern here is that people over-report their sleep by about an hour and a half or 2 hours a night. And interestingly, if we use the self-reports, we'd also overestimate our treatment effect. Right? So if you look at the gap here versus the gap here, people in those groups are telling us they're sleeping more than we actually see in the data. So I think both of those observations are kind of interesting in terms of the study design. Okay. Last thing to look at, the naps. So the naps, we don't have a ton to comment on. It's either you get them or you don't. But for those people who get them, the question of interest is really how much do they sleep. So what we have here is just a plot of how much sleep do you actually get in this half hour period. There's also some mass here at zero, which we've truncated. I think it's about 15 or 20% don't really sleep at all. And then the rest of the people, the modal amount of sleep is about 15 minutes. That makes sense. Takes a little time to fall asleep. We wake you back up at the end of the 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm. So do you give them 30 minutes in the nap pod, or do you give them 40 minutes to get in, settle in, then sleep?
It's like 30 minutes from the time they're in the cabin to when we wake them up. And one other thing I should mention, which I think is actually important to the sleep inertia point, is that given what the sleep scientists told us about the idea of sleep inertia, we actually put this on a separate floor. We make them like tramp up and down the stairs, splash a little water in their face, like try to get going again after the nap. And I think that actually does make some difference. We'll probably see it more in things like the economic effects than we will in the health effects. But I think if you guys are thinking about napping, there is some question of how do you get back woken back up. And their advice is basically just move around a little and kind of get yourself back in the mode. There's also, this is unrelated to our research at all, but an interesting tip, what's called a caffeine nap, which is you drink a thing of coffee, you sleep for 20 minutes, and then you get back up, and because coffee takes a little time to kick in. So the idea is like you get the full benefits of sleep, and then all of a sudden you like wake up. So I don't know if I should be advocating for this or not, but it exists. All right. Good. All right, so that's everything on the sleep side. Are there any questions on the sleep results or things you found surprising want to discuss? No, just keep plugging ahead. All right.
One thing I think is fascinating, I think there are strong links with a lot of the arguments around collecting biomarkers compared to self-reports. And I work mainly in sexual reproductive health, is, you know, we're seeing increasingly evidence that shows how out self-reports are, whether or not that's how much you sleep, sexual partners you have,
right,
whatever it is. I mean, I think it's really interesting. So that's just a kind of a broad point.
Yeah, and a really good one. And it's actually been interesting to me in talking to participants how adamant they are, because we tell them how much they sleep based on the sleep watch, and they're like, no, that's not true. Because, I mean, we provide the incentives based on it and that sort of thing, and so they actually do, they care about this, and they really do believe that they sleep more. I think there is some... You know, this plot suggests there is also some experimental demand effect. But I really do think that this gap is deeply held belief. Like, I don't know that you could actually be biased people about it. They seem to really believe it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did you expect such a difference between self-reporting and actual collecting data?
We did. There's actually pretty good evidence that people are terrible at reporting this. I don't know how... I think the gap is a little bigger than I might have guessed, and that partly has to do with the sleep efficiency gap. Mm-hmm. You know, if everybody uses this heuristic, I go to bed at X, I get up at Y, what is the difference between those numbers? Mm-hmm. Then if your sleep efficiency is worse, that gap gets bigger. Yeah. And so I think we expected a gap. It seems like the gap was potentially even bigger than we thought it would be.
Mm-hmm. Are they entering data for
the study? We actually make up the data.
And do they know that?
They don't. They definitely don't. We want it to be very realistic. We make it up because we want to be able to control features of the data, like string length. because we actually have some things we want to look into on that front. But it basically, to them, just looks like a college application. So what we do is we generate fake data that looks like a college application. So it has fields like for an email address, phone numbers, recommenders, etc. And then they just take what looks like written script and turn it into text. Yeah, but they don't know that it's fake. We did try to get real data. It just turned out it was really hard to do in a way that was very systematic in the way we wanted. Okay, so in terms of the health outcomes, I'm going to talk through about seven different health outcomes today. We have some objective measures of health, including blood pressure, physical performance, which is captured by biking for half an hour on a stationary bike, where you're incentivized, you're paid for every kilometer you cover. Weight, which we measure, again, objectively using scales, you might expect, that's in kilos. Alcohol and tobacco consumption, because we potentially thought that if sleep changes what's called inhibitory control, which is basically your ability to override impulses, which there's some evidence for, then it may also change self-control and consumption of, for lack of a, I hate this term, but sin goods, alcohol and tobacco, things that people may not necessarily want to consume but may be addicted to. And then we also look at illness. We have self-reports here and absences from work. Whenever somebody's absent from work, we call them up and we just say, why are you absent? And so we can also look at absences due to health reasons, say, versus, you know, going to a wedding or a funeral or something. We look at different aspects of well-being, so pain, sadness, and stress, and positive aspects of well-being as well, happiness and subjective well-being, and all these are standardized survey measures. Okay. So let me start with blood pressure. You guys are all generally pretty young, so let me tell you a little bit about blood pressure for those of you who don't know. You have two parts of your blood pressure measurement. It's called diastolic and systolic blood pressure. This is the lower number. This is the higher number. This number over here should be below 80, and this number over here should be below 130. And lower is better for blood pressure. Okay, so we're using the standard plots here. Control is in red. Sleep treatment, which is the devices, is in blue. And sleep and incentives is in green. And what you can see is actually, first, people had pretty good blood pressure in the sample, which wasn't actually something that we expected. I think that largely has to do with the relative youth of our population. Remember, the average age is around 35. So there aren't a ton of people kind of up above these thresholds, which suggests hypertension. And the second thing that you notice is there's maybe a little bit of suggestive evidence, say, in here, that in fact blood pressure is lower in our treatment groups than it is in the control group. But there's a lot of overlap in those distributions. It's not some huge change that we're seeing. We can look at that in a regression as well. And remember, data's still coming in, so we're still kind of underpowered. But what you do see is there are negative coefficients. Blood pressure does seem to be a little bit lower in our treatment groups. You should notice here, what I've done is just called pooled treatment. I took the sleep group, the devices group, and the incentive group, and stuck them together because they're both moving sleep in the same direction. And this improves power. So everything seems to be shifting down, but nothing significant at this point. Interestingly, a lot of that shift does seem to be happening right around the point where hypertension, which is the threshold the doctors use for too high blood pressure, kicks in. So it does seem like if things are moving, they're kind of moving at a point that might matter. But at the moment, at least, that's not a significant difference. All right, the next thing that we have people do, as I was saying, they cycle on an exercise bike for half an hour on the last day of the study. This is not a regular occurrence. So this is the setup. And they're paid for every kilometer they cover. And what you can see here is, in fact, the treatment group does go faster. It looks like they may end up covering more distance. Right now, that's not significant, but they're certainly moving at a higher rate, or at least their highest speed is a bit higher. So that's been interesting for us. I wouldn't have guessed that, given what you see in the literature. We can also look at weight. This is all in kilos. So this first column is just looking at weight. This is what's called winsorizing the data. It's taking the outliers for the changes and shrinking them down to the 90th percentile, because we have what we guess are problems with the scales rather than people changing their weight enormously. We divide people also to look at people who start at a healthy normal weight and people who start in the overweight category. So these are BMI measurements, and this is people who start overweight by the WHO characterization. So what we see here about a half a kilo over the course of a month in the treatment group. We don't see any net effect of the nap, although it's definitely less sleep time. That's robust to Windsorization of the data, and it's luckily concentrated among the people who you would want it to be concentrated among. Right, it's not that the people who are underweight, which there are actually people in India who are significantly underweight, are losing a huge amount of weight. It's more that people who start overweight are losing weight, which is a good thing. I should also note this is an unusual distribution, just looking at these sample sizes. So the distribution in India is about a third underweight, a third overweight, and a third in the middle. And so we do actually have a population that's more overweight than typical of the population at large. Okay. So alcohol and tobacco is the next one. And what we have here is two different measures. We have for tobacco, cigarettes, and for alcohol, people tend to drink hard alcohol there, mainly men drink, very few women. So we have number consumed and amount spent. And what you can see is these effects are all negative for tobacco consumption. They're going in a direction you might expect. Again, not significant. These are quite noisy estimates at this point. I would note, though, even though these are in fact not significant, they're actually quite large. So if you look at the magnitude of these coefficients, and all these tables will always have the control mean down here as a reference point. So the average number consumed across the whole population is 0.27 in a day. This decline is actually about a 20% decline from the base rate. So if in fact these do turn out to be significant as we get more, it would actually be a pretty interesting finding. I don't know if that's going to happen, but you should always pay attention both to the magnitude and the direction.
Is this self-reported?
It is self-reported. We do actually breathalyze people in the morning because some people in the population do drink quite a lot, and we will look at that data. We have not yet. Very few people drink in the morning, though. We are curious because we wanted to control for potentially if people are working drunk, which happens. did you have a question? Same question. Okay. So alcohol, I think we're again for the overnight seeing directionally and kind of in magnitude effects fairly large, but not significant at this point. Nothing on the nap there. The next results I find totally puzzling. So if anyone has any thoughts on them, I would love to hear them. These are self-reported health measures. So what we do is we ask people at the kind of periodically. In the last, you know, X days, have you had any of these symptoms, and how many days have you had them? And what we see is in the pooled treatment group, it's generally a nothing, except for potentially an increase in reported fever. And in the NAP treatment, there's some kind of negative effects across these two, and then some kind of nothing. So fever and cough are by far most common. But it's puzzling to me that we get different direction effects here, and of course, you know, we have a lot of tests that might just be noise, but it is a bit surprising to me that you see those differences. The one thing I can say on this is that whatever those effects are, they don't seem to be big enough that people are missing work because of them. So you may have these symptoms, but it's not actually impacting how much you're showing up to work in a significant way.
Mm-hmm. Is
the fever self-reported? It is. Yeah. So we didn't want to get into things that involve saliva. For a variety of reasons, so we don't actually take temperature, but we do ask them if they had a fever or a cough or any of the other symptoms. Yeah.
Is all of that asked in English, or is it just the work you do in English?
So we have a whole local staff. The lab employs like 50 or 60 people across all the projects, and so they speak Tamil, which is the local language, to the participants.
And stuff like fever is not only translated, but also culturally translated into whatever that means.
That's right. It's fully, everything is translated. There's no English used except for words that don't exist in Tamil. So like some of the instruction about how to do the data entry has words like mouse and that sort of thing, which like there's just no word for it. But generally everything is in the local language. Yeah.
With regards to correlation with absence from work, I'm wondering if absence from work due to sickness or illness was already prevalent before the study or not, whether people were already taking leave from work if they were unwell, and if that practice of either skipping work because they're unwell or not skipping work because they're unwell was already prevalent before the study or not.
So I think the general rate of absences is pretty low in our study. It's about 15%, which I guess maybe is higher than it would be here, but that encompasses all reasons. And by far the most common reasons have more to do with, I guess I would say, social and family obligations. So the most common reasons they report are like, I had a wedding, I had a funeral, I had to take care of this person, that sort of thing. So there are definitely absences due to illness, but they don't seem to be the primary thing. I think it also is a bit seasonal. So there are times of the year when there are more mosquitoes and we get people with malaria and that sort of thing. But in general, it's probably not the primary thing. But certainly, there would be, I would say that the absence levels are a bit higher than you would expect, say, in the UK.
Question about, when was this study performed? Was it during summer, during winter, throughout the year?
So it actually is a rolling enrollment, so we can't enroll 450 people at once. Just our study office isn't big enough. So what we do is we enroll about 40 people at a time, and then we just continuously, as people exit, we enroll new people. So it actually runs over the course of 18 months, and it's still going on. So one of the things that we're hoping to do as we get further through the whole year cycle is to look at seasonal effects as well. We haven't done that yet, but it is on the to-do list. Yeah.
I know this goes back to what we were discussing a while before. When you're doing a sampling for the people who enrolled in the study, are
mm-hmm.
all of these participants living in an area near your office, or are they from varied geographies?
They're allowed to be from anywhere. Practically speaking, because they have to commute every day, they tend to be either from regions around the office or easily commutable locations.
Mm-hmm.
So we do actually locate the office in the heart of the Old City, which is on two major train lines. As well as shared auto routes and that sort of thing.
Okay.
But practically speaking, I would say most people live within about 45 minutes of the office travel time, which varies substantially in distance.
So usually most of your respondents, most of your participants would be in an area where there's high noise and high traffic.
Yes. And Chennai is a big city, so I think the broader metro area is something like 8 million people,
mm-hmm.
which by India standards is not big, but by any other regional standard it is very large. And it is very densely populated, and especially the areas that we're drawing from, I think, tend to be particularly densely populated because it's lower income areas, which tend to have kind of very, very high density. Yeah. Actually, I could go back eventually, but we had some initial pictures where I was showing kind of like poor sleep conditions. So if you saw the concrete housing, that's a government housing block. And a lot of people in those types of structures. It's kind of four stories, each family has one room, sort of thing. Yeah. Okay. So the next thing to look at is different aspects of well-being, both negative and positive. We have two different ways to actually measure this. We ask at some frequency every few days throughout the study, which is the data that I'm showing here, and we also ask a different set of questions that are more complete at the beginning and the end. And we actually get somewhat different results between the two, so I wouldn't put too much weight on these regressions yet because we're still trying to figure out what's going on. But I think the overall takeaway is that there's not a lot going on in this, which was quite surprising to me. So we don't see any significant changes in the levels of pain that people experience, the amount of time they feel sad, how stressed out they feel. We do see a little bit potentially on anxiety, but we're still working on that as well to clean that data, so I wouldn't oversell that. We can also look at the flip side of that, instead of how bad do you feel, how good do you feel. And so what I'm showing you here is by day in the study, again, we have these kind of high frequency surveys, how happy do you feel using a standard measure, where one corresponds to not at all happy, and five is very happy, so this is the Gallup poll type question. And interestingly, you don't see a lot of action with the nighttime sleep. There's not a lot of difference there. But you do actually see a meaningful gap for the people in the nap treatment, which I would not have been my prior, but is actually, I think, very, very interesting to me. And we're actually seeing some of that in the economic results as well. The nap is actually more potent than we would have guessed in a variety of different dimensions. We asked a similar question about well-being overall, which has more to do about kind of long-term satisfaction. We don't see a lot on this measure, which is kind of interesting to me. It suggests that it's more of kind of a long-term process, which I guess is built into the question itself, basically asking if you had to represent where you are in life with a ladder, where would you be on that ladder? And this looks pretty stable over time. The last set of results I want to go through are related to how people experience this and what it does to how willing they are to pay to invest in sleep. Before I get to that, are there any other questions or thoughts on the health results? Any thoughts on the weird illness stuff?
Are we measuring stress and anxiety?
Those are also standardized survey measures. So there are a lot of standardized scales that exist, and we just chose some of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just one thing that comes to mind is that they have just a 1 month job.
Mm-hmm.
So as they get towards the end of that job, then the anxiety of they know they're going to have to find a new job will start to kick in. So they'll be excited at the beginning, and you see that in both the control and the treatment.
Yeah, especially here.
It's trending down.
Yeah, I noticed that as well.
So that's, I think that could be potentially kind of, I mean, it suggests that they would value more job stability.
I think that is very true. Unfortunately, yeah, this was as long as we could do, but I absolutely agree. I mean, part of the reason that, you know, the randomized control trial is kind of such a good standard of evidence is it does let you look at those types of things with this counterfactual. And I think we were very concerned about exactly that type of thing. You know, as you go through the study, there are a lot of things that could be changing. You get more used to it, but simultaneously you're stressed out about it ending. Maybe, you know, I don't know which way on net that would necessarily go, but it does look like it trends downward here, which is interesting. Mm-hmm.
From my experience in Delhi, within a particular, within the urban poor sector, the notion of what qualifies as fever,
mm-hmm.
and the notion of what qualifies as small kinds of illnesses varies very widely, so it
yes.
might not actually even be fever. But the whole feeling a particular way might count as fever. So
I agree. I know what you're talking about, where it's like, I just didn't feel good, it's sometimes fever.
Yeah.
And I think we're kind of okay with that, in a sense, right? Like, the goal is to say, how is your immune system functioning? How healthy are you?
Mm-hmm.
And so if it's this kind of broader interpretation, I think the thing that would be worrisome is if sleeping changes your interpretation of whether or not you had this fever status,
mm-hmm.
rather than whether objectively you have it.
Okay.
That would be worrisome. I don't have a good reason to think that it would, but it is a possible reason. But I agree, it's a bit more amorphous than like I put a thermometer in my mouth and I had a fever that was above 98.6. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just a question, but tell me if I've interpreted wrong. So there didn't seem to be much of an impact on sleep efficiency, but what you were seeing was it the timings of sleep,
mm-hmm.
going to one side. Problems with self-reporting. Is there something to say that, aside from it being earplugs or a mattress or eye mask or whatever it is, that the very act of being involved in a study where there is stuff to do with sleep is a kind of a prompt that, oh, sleep is important, or it's being communicated to me in this study, so it's not to do with wearing the eye mask or the earplugs or whatever combo someone is using, but it's more to do with the, oh, I'm in a space right now or a point in time where somebody is saying to me that sleep, they're interested in my sleep.
That's right.
So I'll think about switching off the telly a bit earlier or putting my phone down a bit earlier.
I think that's a very plausible mechanism. I mean, we're talking to people about their sleep all the time. And so it's very clear that we're interested in it, and we do actually give them information, like doctors say sleep is good for you. We're very vague about that information on purpose because we don't want to say biased things that we're asking about later. Like, we don't tell them sleep makes you happy, or we don't tell them sleep makes you have fewer fevers or something like that, because then we worry they'll just parrot that back to us. But we do just say, you know, doctors say sleep is a good thing, you should sleep more, and, you know, we encourage people in that group to sleep. And I fully believe that could be a significant part of what's driving this, the sleep effects that we see. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just thinking about me, when I'm lying in bed, staring at the
ceiling.
That's
what I love about this study.
I'm like, get the impression that I'm going to die at any moment because you have all, you know, you just, and then it's time to get up and you forget about it and you're fine. So maybe they're spending more time in bed, so. You know, all sorts of little things that you're more attuned to, and actually that I think on a more serious level, there's a transitional phase between being awake and being asleep,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of weird.
right? I guess the question is why the nap people wouldn't, but I guess their sleep is very different. It's like in and out much more quickly sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can do some debriefing on that. That would be interesting to see whether people are kind of thinking about it more, but like if we're priming them on, you know, sleep and health or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because the fever thing is probably one of these generic, you know, I don't...
Yes. Yeah, I think it is.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Just thinking a little bit about the previous question. So the people who were the treatment and the control group, they were working together, right? So they were receiving
yes.
the same kind of information at the same time, and about sleep is good for you and all that. So everything was happening to both groups at the same time.
So generally everything is happening to both groups, like they're both working, they're both doing all of that the same. But when we do the kind of check-in about people's sleep and we tell them, like, here's how much you slept, here are your incentives and that sort of thing, we take them to, like, a separate, like we call it a survey cabin. It's kind of like the nap cabin. It has, like, curtains on either side and you can't see anybody and it isolates you a bit. So the control group does not get any of that information. Yeah. It's a good point. Okay. So the last thing that I wanted to talk about a little bit is just whether going through this whole experience of having these sleep aids or taking these naps changes the value you place on sleep, and in particular the value you place on the sleep aids that we gave people to try to sleep more, which is one of the better proxies we have. We also have a survey where we try to elicit their beliefs, like if you were in this group, how different would your experience have been? I won't present on that today, I'll just tell you a little bit about this willingness to pay side. So what we do in this is at the end of the study, we collect back all of the sleep devices from the sleep group, the sleep with devices group and the incentives group on day 29, right after the study ends. And then we ask people to come back on day 31, and we do some other kind of follow-up stuff with them. And one of that follow-up things is we do an incentive-compatible elicitation of how much are you willing to pay to get back or to get these sleep aids. And what I mean by incentive-compatible is that we basically give people a list of prices, and we ask them, would you buy at this price, would you buy at this price, would you buy at this price, and then we randomly draw a price, and if their willingness to pay is higher than that, they get the good at that price, and if their willingness to pay is lower than that, then they don't get the good. And so their best strategy is actually just to say exactly what's true, because if they basically lie and they say, oh, I wouldn't be willing to pay that even though I would, they might miss out on getting something they would like to get. So we explain that to them in great detail. And we actually do this with a few other things in advance, like a pencil and a cap and a few other things, so they understand the process well, like you should just tell us the truth. And then we do this with all these different sleep aids. So what does that look like? Well, overall, our data says that people are willing to pay most for the mattress. They're also willing to pay some for the pillow and blanket, and very little for the eye shade and the earplugs. These are the only goods that we sell for them. Just to give you a sense of scale, the mattress here, this is all in rupees. The exchange, I think, is about 90 to the pound at this point. So this is a bit over a pound that they'd be willing to pay for basically kind of a light camping mattress. They cost us substantially more than that. I think the market price is something closer to £6. So it's substantially below the market rate for most of these goods. But on the other hand, it's actually a fair amount of money. If you sum up these willingnesses to pay across the goods that they're bidding on, that's about half a day's salary. So I don't know how you interpret that, but it is kind of that's their willingness to pay overall. The second thing we look at is that differential by the group, right? So one hypothesis you might have is, oh, I went through this sleep thing where I got all these things at home, I slept with them, it was fantastic, now I'm gonna be more willing to buy it. In fact, that doesn't seem to be true. So we can look, are you willing to pay anything for the item? And no real differences there to speak of. Maybe a little bit higher here, but the base rates are already quite high. This is a negative point estimate, but from a base of one, so still everyone is basically willing to purchase it. And if you look at how much they're willing to pay, conditional on being willing to buy it all, also no substantial differences across most of these items. Right, so if anything, the treatment groups are generally a little bit lower bidding than the control group here, which suggests that we aren't seeing a huge impact of having had these devices on how much you value them. That doesn't necessarily mean that people don't value the sleep. It could be that, in fact, now they learn sleep is valuable and they'll just do it on their own. They don't need these things for it. But it does suggest that they don't actually value these things kind of substantially more for having gone through the experience, at least. Okay. So let me just recap, then I'll talk a little bit about policy. So where does that leave us? Well, on the sleep side, we do have now good evidence that people sleep very little, about 5.5 hours a night, and in a very disrupted way. We can actually meaningfully impact that sleep. We can increase it by about 25 minutes a night by giving people devices and encouragement, and then an extra 15 minutes on top of that, so 40 minutes in total if we add incentives. The 30-minute nap period gives them a total of 15 minutes of extra sleep. There's a little bit of crowd out to nighttime sleep in this, but not a huge amount. And this extra sleep doesn't actually change your willingness to pay for those devices to improve sleep. There are some health effects. I think we'll know a little bit more as we get further through the study. But I would say blood pressure seems to be going down a little bit, but not by a lot and not significantly. People are improving in their physical performance. They are losing weight. There's some suggestive but certainly non-significant effects on tobacco and alcohol consumption. Very mixed evidence on illness, and not a ton of change on these kind of mental health subjective well-being measures either, other than the happiness effect from naps. So, you know, I think to me this set of results is interesting, both for what it confirms, that people think sleep is very related to weight loss, but also what it isn't showing. Right, there's fairly good evidence from these sleep labs that you do actually see changes in some of your biomarkers for acute sleep deprivation related to your immune system. So far, that doesn't seem to be showing up, at least over the course of a month, in actual kind of heavy disease burden environments. Okay. So just taking a moment to step back from that, the first thing I want to mention on the policy side is that this is actually, the study is done in partnership and heavily funded by the government of Tamil Nadu, which is the state where it takes place. We thank them for their support. It's very kind of them, and we're excited that they've joined us on the study. I think the reason that they were really very interested in it is, one, they're actually a very progressive government. It's a kind of very kind of more liberal and progressive state in many ways. And so they're actually collaborating with researchers on a variety of different studies, everything from rice fortification to sleep deprivation. But they also think, you know, this information would be valuable to them in quite a number of different ways, potentially. First, they have no idea whether sleep deprivation is actually a problem in their population. They have no data. They have no good way of knowing that. So this is going to give them some data on that. In addition, if it is a problem and if there are kind of harms associated with poor sleep, there are a lot of things they could potentially do to try to address that. Right, from an urban policy point of view, one of the groups that we're collaborating with in the government is what's called the Slum Clearance Board, which is an unfortunate name, but is basically the urban housing and urban planning group. And they were, you know, were talking to us about things like, should we be placing the windows in our houses differently to reduce noise at night? Those types of decisions are things that would be easy changes for them, which could actually potentially influence how much sleep people get. Also, there are potential regulations or kind of policy implications more on the firm side, where you could certainly work with firms to try to encourage, say, nap policies or the like, if they turn out to be particularly effective, or they might just adopt them if there's good evidence, right? Imagine that our naps actually improve productivity. You should show that to firms. Maybe they actually think that's interesting and useful for them. And the last reason I would put, which is a little bit more of the skeptical person in me, is that the government also has a long tradition of pre-elections giving out free stuff. And one of the things that they like to know is, what do people like in their free stuff? And so knowing a bit more about free stuff and what people enjoy and value out of it is actually quite useful to them. So that's another piece of information about kind of willingness to pay about different goods that we can provide and the like. And also how effective we think those goods are and how much people value them. The last thing I think I wanted to just put out here was, to me, one of the more interesting things about this study has been thinking about how it contrasts with what we think we know from sleep research in labs. It's just a very different environment, right? You think about that guy dressed from head to toe in electrodes, and what we're learning from keeping him up all night and running cognitive tests on him versus taking this to the field and saying, in fact, most of the sleep deprivation we're worried about is chronic sleep deprivation, and a lot of the outcomes we worry about are long-run outcomes. And so it really does say there should be kind of, I think, increased emphasis on trying to study this in this very natural environment. And I would say even more than we do. You know, we do a month because that's what we can do. But if you could do this for a year at a much less intensive level, I think that would also offer really, really valuable information. So I think we probably have like a few minutes left for questions. I'm happy to take them.
So I have a small question. Were there any conditionalities imposed by the government of Tamil Nadu?
Conditionalities in like
on
what we're studying?
Funding.
Not hugely. I mean, we basically had to pitch the study to them, and we said, like, here's roughly what we want to do, and they did want us to, like, work with their slum clearance board on recruiting participants for some of those areas and looking at differences and that sort of thing. But generally speaking, no, they were just generally pretty supportive. Yeah. Can I get a question?
Yeah, I just thought the question of chronic is really key, because if there was an immediate well-being and health response to getting a little bit more sleep, then you'd think that that signal would be very strong and people would naturally start to understand. What's tricky are things where the signal is very weak,
right,
and where giving people information and then that's not obvious to them helps them to achieve better outcomes. So you would expect with the sleep situation that like the well-being and the health might be really over a much longer period of time. And the fact that it doesn't show up immediately is exactly why there is a scarcity and a bad amount of sleep, because people don't have that immediate feedback to be able to make the right decisions.
I absolutely agree. And I mean, think of the measures we're using as well, like blood pressure. I mean, you would never pick up those effects as an individual in terms of blood pressure, even if they got substantially bigger over time. And it's also just an incredibly noisy environment. I think one thing I've generally found about all these learning arguments in this context is just, I would never learn in that context. There are a million things going on in your daily life, and they're all shocking you in different ways. And so it's hard to imagine that you can discern signal from that noise unless that signal is incredibly strong. And so we have these kind of, I think economists in general, these strong beliefs that people will over time, and by looking at neighbors, eventually they'll learn. That is not at all obvious to me. I couldn't agree more that, like, in this case, you know, unless the effect is enormous and, you know, you change your productivity overnight or something, I wouldn't be surprised if people never learn on their own. And that's part of the reason we're doing the work on beliefs as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How much do you pay them in the month? And is it the same amount for men and women? And do they get, I mean, usually, do they get paid the same amount?
So we offer a piece rate wage because we actually want to incentivize output, and we want to benchmark also the effect of sleep against the wage rate. But what I mean by that is essentially, say we get a 5% bump in productivity, is that big, is that small? From a firm's point of view, what would you have to do to the wage to get to that? So we actually change randomly the piece rate that they face as well. And so the wage is the same across men and women, but people earn different amounts depending on their skill and data entry. And typically they earn something like, I would say like £5 a day.
And you pay them daily?
We pay them daily, that's right. Yeah. All right.
Heather, thank you so much. I mean, I think you can tell from the range of questions here that there's sort of fascinating in terms of sort of different social science things to think about.
And I love
the methodology of research design, the policy implications, in addition to the health outcomes. So,
and thank you all for.